Hello, rummage items donators. I see you've already started bringing things. I'm thrilled. There is another reminder to check your house. This is another reminder to check your house and garage for donatable items for the May 14th and 15th rummage sale. We'll talk about the plant sale a little bit further on, but please read your newsletter because it has all the details. Today was the first day you could start bringing items and place them at the back of the social hall. So if you just are so, you get the urge, you can drive home and get some things and bring them after the service. Please sign up on the sign-up sheets. We do need all the help we can get. See me, Kaz, or Esther after the service with any questions. Thank you so much.
After all your hard work helping with our rummage sale, please plan to be there here Saturday night, May 15th, for our youth group coffee house. The reckoning evening of reverie and rare refreshments. I don't know what that is. Sorry. Slight foreigner here. Okay. There will be a treat of music and camaraderie. Please join us. Okay, there you go. Still need people to sign up for church lawn mowing. See John Kuhn for questions. Our sign-up sheet is on the social hall bulletin board. Okay. And that's all the announcement. And I invite you to greet those of us. Oh, I'm sorry, John. There is one more.
Sorry. Loud enough as I am, I'll speak from here. I just want to give you a brief update as treasurer. Pledges. We've gotten pledges in from most people for next year, but we have about 1 week left. I really need to get in as many of the remaining pledges as possible so that we can make decisions for the budget that have to be made the following week as far as hiring or any other things that require money. I'll be sending out the next few days to everyone that turned in a pledge. If you're on email, you'll get an email listing showing what the pledge is that I supported for you for next year. Once I've done that, I'll send something to the whole member list to say that if you didn't get the message from me, then somehow I didn't get a pledge from you. And it would be great if you could contact me in that case. One other note. With me getting far behind on things as I am. Yes, we are still paying dues this year, and we're hopefully changing that for next year. That's going to be a board meeting item, annual meeting item. And the dues will be the exact same as last year, $78.50. I'll be getting that into the order of service next week and sending that on the member list as well. Okay, and of course, if you have any questions at any time about your donations or pledges, just give me a call, send me an email. Thank you.
Any more announcement that I forgot? Okay, no. All righty. Now I invite you to greet those sitting around you.
Good morning, Kaz. Thank you for filling in on short notice.
If you are visiting with us today, we particularly welcome you. Please sign the guest ledger on the foyer. On the visitor's table in the foyer. There is a variety of information available on that table about our church and Unitarian Universalism. Help yourself to any that interests you. I will be in the social hall after the service. If you have any question about our church, or if you have been visiting here for a while and you would like the information of becoming a member, I would like to talk to you about that as well. If you are visiting with us, with your children, it is our custom for children to remain with us until the offertory, at which time they go to religious education classes. Your child is welcome to join them or remain in the service. If you like to go along and observe your children's classes, please do so. The nursery is just out the door to my right and across the entryway if there is a need for the child's service during the service. Okay. We always enjoy getting to know you, our guests. If any member have brought guests today, we'll be pleased if you introduce them. Ready? If any guests have brought themselves, please feel comfortable to introduce yourself. Yes. Wow. Welcome. Okay. Everybody is invited to gather in the social hall after the service for refreshment and conversation. The conversation is a good place to gather for further discussion of the service. Today is the first Sunday of the month, and we have food pantry collection. And today's collection will go to Oconomowoc Food Pantry. Please put your cell phone on a silence mode during the service. I hope you find this morning's service inspiring. Today's speaker is David Pyle, is a ministry on a primary fellowship with the UUA and will be ordained by the Unitarian Church of Evanston on June 6th. David is a chaplain resident of Lutheran General Hospital and Rainbow Hospice in Park Ridge, Illinois, a U.S. Army chaplain candidate and the founder of the UU Outreach Ministry to the Great Lakes Naval Station. Thank you.
Good morning. I want to thank Reverend Espenson and Reverend Lobin for the invitation to be here with you all this weekend and this morning. Our opening words come from Albert Schweitzer. Anyone who proposes to do good must not expect people to roll stones out of his way or her way, but must accept their lot calmly, even if someone rolls a few more upon it. Our chalice lighting this morning, I invite you to join with me by responding with the congregational response printed in your order of service. We light this chalice to illuminate the world we seek. In our loving, may we be just. In our justice, may we be prophetic. And in our prophetic voice, may we create peace. May love shine forth through us today. May light of reason guide our way. May beauty, truth, and joy become a flame that burns in everyone. And that's supposed to be sung, isn't it? Let's sing it. I invite all who are young in body, spirit, or any other way that you want to come forward for the story for all ages. Well, hi you all. My name is David. I know it's kind of weird. There's a strange guy up here today. I'm going to tell a story, and I need your all's help. Okay? Is that all right? Y'all help me tell a story? Okay. There are going to be three different types of animals in this story this morning, and I need you all to speak for the animals when they come up. Okay? So the first type of animal is a mouse. What does a mouse say? Squeak! So every time you hear me say the word mouse or mice, I need you to squeak. So let's try it. Squeak. There we go. All right. Now there's a cat in this story as well. Now what does a cat say? Meow. Okay, you're getting it. So every time I mention the cat, I need y'all to meow. All right, let's try it. There we go. Y'all can join in too if you want. One more animal. There's a particular dog named Fred. Fred's kind of the hero of our story. So What does a dog do? Ruff or bark. Either one is fine. So whenever I mention Fred or a dog, you all? Okay. This is an original story of mine, but it's based on an East African folktale. It's titled, Why Do Dogs Bark at Cats? Okay? There once was a community of mice who lived in a small town many, many years ago. It was a poor town, but it had nice people in it who did not mind the mice all that much. The days were warm and the nights were cool, and there were often some bits of food that the people didn't need anymore, so the mice had plenty enough to eat. There was only one problem. Living with the people, there was a cat. Now this cat was a mean, mean cat who did not really like mice all that much. Do you have a cat? Is your cat nice? Okay, this was not a nice cat. I have a nice cat, and this was not a nice cat. It was mean, and it would chase all the little mice all over the town whenever it saw them. The town also had a dog. But the dog mostly laid around and almost never bothered the mice. After one particularly close escape by a couple of mice being chased by the cat,
Y'all are good. After one particularly close escape, all of the mice gathered together for a community meeting in the church. Imagine that, ministers. Hundreds of mice came together in the basement of the local church to discuss how they could find a way to be safe from the cat. One mouse, a very smart and industrious mouse named Squeaky, came to the meeting with a plan. He was a Unitarian mouse. They all knew that there was one house in town in which the cat almost never came near. And that was the house where the dog lived. So Squeaky proposed that all of the mice work together to build a series of tunnels and little mouse-sized escape holes into walls and fences. Holes big enough that the mouse could get through, but too small for the cat. When the cat went hunting for the mice, they would all use these little holes and tunnels to escape and run as fast as they could to where the dog was. They all thought this was a wonderful plan, and so it was voted for unanimously. The other mice were not Unitarians. It was voted for unanimously. To honor Squeaky for coming up with this plan, all the mice started calling out his name. They said, it was agreed that when the cat was around, they would call Squeak to let everyone know of the danger. So what did the mice say when they saw the cat? She knows the story. Right. You listen really well. So that night, the mice got to work. And by morning, they had cut little mouse-sized escape hatches in all the doors and fences and walls across town. That morning, the mean old cat got up and saw a mouse finishing up a door. When the cat was about to pounce on the mouse yelled, "Squeak!" as loud as he could. And all the other mice went running through the doors and escape hatches right to the dog's house. Now, no one had thought to ask the dog if it was okay for all the mice to come over to his house whenever the cat was around. Needless to say, the dog was a little surprised when he woke up that morning and found that he was surrounded by hundreds of little mice. There were mice on his back, on his paws, in his food bowl, and even hanging off of his dog collar, there were mice. "What in the world are you all doing here?" barked the dog, whose name was Fred. "I did not invite you all over here to my house early this morning, and get out of my food bowl." The mice were not afraid of the dog because he had never been mean to them. They told him of their new plan of how to protect themselves from the cat. "Well, other than coming over to my house early in the morning, it sounds like a good plan, but I don't have room for you all. And besides, if you all are always hiding here, you'll never find any food. Why don't you keep the doors and the escape hatches and just go tie a bell around the cat's neck? And that way you will know when he is coming and you can hide in lots of places other than my doghouse." "But Mr. Fred," said Squeaky, "we are all of us very small, and if we come that close to the cat, he will catch us. And then who knows what will happen? None of us could get close enough to put a bell around his neck." So Fred the dog thought and thought and thought and then said, "Okay, I have an idea. How about I'll keep a lookout, and whenever I see a cat, especially that mean old cat that chases you mice, come on, you got to help me tell the story, I will bark as loud as I can. That way all of you mice will know to hide. I will even get my other dog friends to do the same around the world. And you'll have plenty of time to hide in other places than my food bowl. Is it a deal?" The mice all came up and shook on it. So later that day, when Fred the dog saw the mean old cat ready to chase a few of his mice friends, he let out a loud, and all the mice went to hide. And that is why dogs bark at cats. So what do they say? Mice? Cats? Dogs. Thank you all.
Our opening hymn, which we'll want to sing, not squeak, meow, or bark, is number 20. Yeah, please stand as you're willing and able, and Christy will play some, lead us into it. Freely have we received of gifts that minister to our needs of body and spirit. Therefore, gladly we bring to our church and its wide concerns a portion of this bounty. And so with that, we will now have our offertory and pass the baskets. Thank you. And now we've reached a sacred time in our service where we take a few minutes and share the joys and concerns we've had for the past week. So, as always, please state your name, and as you have a joy or concern, Usher will give you the mic, and you can light a candle to reflect on your joy or concern. And I'd like to light our memorial candle this morning out of, I guess, a deep concern for the oil well in the Gulf of Mexico that's leaking. I guess now it's 5,000 barrels a day instead of 1,000 barrels a day, and they don't really know yet how they're going to plug it, and, you know, this is could be on track to be the worst environmental disaster in the U.S. in U.S. history. So in this case, it'd be in hopes that if any good comes out of it, maybe that it moves us closer and sooner to a path that doesn't use oil and fossil fuel.
An obvious joy is Lori's ordination yesterday, and she is now an official Unitarian Universalist minister, and so that's a great joy and delight for us and for the world.
I'm Christy. I'd like to light a candle for my grandparents that passed away 5 weeks from each other, and bless them, Red and Regina. But I'd also like to light a candle of joy for my brother and his wife who gave birth to their first child, nice healthy baby.
I'm Anita, and I'd like to light a joy. I just finished up a very extensive 3-week course on hair color, and it's just increased my business quite a bit.
So. I'm Mary, and I'd like to light a candle of joy and concern. I'm concerned because my friend Eileen Moores is in really the last probably few days of end-stage brain cancer. And her family's gathered around her, and the real joy is that despite just an extremely severe tumor that is very large, she's not in any pain. So I'm very joyful for that.
Hi. I'm E.C. Goggio, and along with what you were saying before, I also want to give thanks to all these amazing people who are working around the clock to try to save the wildlife and doing what they can in light of what such a terrible disaster. So, you know, everybody should be very appreciative of their work.
I'm Lori, and I am overflowing with gratitude today. But along with all of the other joys, Would you please light a candle of joy that my mother was able to be here yesterday? Those of you who were here observed that she's obviously in ill health, and there were many times over the last year that I didn't think she would make it. So very, very joyful for that.
I am Zaya, and I would like to light a candle of joy for being again here in Wisconsin after 10 years.
And I'll light one last candle for the joys and concerns that we leave in our hearts today.
invite you to turn in your hymnals to our responsive reading. Number 591, I Call That Church Free, by James Luther Adams. Please respond with the sections that are in italics. I call that church free which enters into covenant with the ultimate source of existence. It binds together families and generations, protecting against the idolatry of any human claim to absolute truth or authority. I call that church free which brings individuals into a caring, trusting fellowship. It is open to insight and conscience from every source. It bursts through rigid tradition, giving rise to new and living language, to new and broader fellowship. The goal is the prophethood and the priesthood of all believers, the one for the liberty of prophesying, the other for the ministry of healing. Amen. Before our time of meditation this morning, I invite you to go ahead and open your hymnals to number 4. Wild Waves, I Brought My Spirit to the Sea. What I'd like to do is, instead of closing by ringing the ring-gong bell, our meditation, I'd like for us to stay in silent meditation until the music begins playing and move right into the hymn. So we're going to use that space of the initial verse of the hymn to bring yourself slowly out of reflection. I invite you to join me in a period of silent and spoken prayer and meditation on the times that you have been a leader in your life, on times when you were not the boss, but not the person in charge, but someone whom others willingly followed. Please join me in a spirit of prayer and meditation. Remember when you were someone whom others look to for answers. Remember when you were someone who saw something that needed doing and just decided to do it. Remember when you were someone who taught quietly what needed to be taught. Remember when you were someone who brought hope in a time when others were hopeless. Remember when you were someone who inspired others to a cause. Remember when you were someone who encouraged another to follow their dreams.
Remember when you were someone who stood up to an injustice, big or small. Being a leader is so much larger than what society tells us it is. Think on the times that you have been a leader in your family, in this church, in your community, and in the world. Let us move into a period of silent meditation on the roles of leadership that each of us has carried, is carrying, and will continue to carry. Blessed be. I bring us this reading from the Reverend Ann Oden Heller, a UU minister who has served as the district executive for many of our districts and in several congregations as a minister. This is from her book, Church Works, which is a really good book on how churches operate. She says this, "Consider the skeleton. Consider its armature structure. Everything in the body hangs on the skeleton. Even though the skeleton is below the surface, it defines the shape of the body. Like the human body, the congregational body has a structure, which is its skeleton. On it hangs the spirit, ministry, and good work of the congregation. Have you ever broken a bone? When you break a bone, how does it affect the rest of the body? The glory of modern sciences is that new bones can be replaced. Broken bones, when mended, can grow strong again. The body requires bones to truly support it. When one bone is broken or hurt, the rest of the body must compensate. As the bone mends, the rest of the body stops accommodating. Whole, healthy, and complete skeletons encourage the body to function effectively. The more the bones are used, the stronger they become. Even in extreme old age, exercise encourages stronger bones and better health. Our body's bones work together and are complementary. A church's bones is its leadership." On a rainy Boston afternoon in 1972, two weary men sat in a small room wondering whether to run for their church offices again. They were tired. Tired of controversy. Tired of difficult decisions. Tired of fighting. Both of them had plenty of other things they could be doing with their time. Neither of them had to choose to run for a second term. And most would have understood if they'd chosen not to. Because the practice of leadership had been hard. There were even some who would have been happy to see them go. Sound familiar to anyone? While sitting in that room on a rainy Sunday after church, they together came to a realization. All of the work that they had done over the last 4 years, all of the conflict and strife might have been for nothing if they were to leave now. They were not in service first to themselves, but to a much larger vision of the world. And so they chose to run for office again. Their dedication to the whole that was their faith was greater than the weariness they were feeling in that moment. Those two men were Bob West and Joe Fisher. And the offices they chose to run for again were Unitarian Universalist Association President and Unitarian Universalist Association Moderator, the top professional and lay positions in our association of congregations. They were called to be leaders of our association during what was almost a perfect storm of problems that almost signaled the collapse of our denomination and perhaps an end to Unitarian Universalism as an organized movement. Some may remember those days, but few had the access to know all of the challenges which our association faced at the time. There was a financial crisis in which banks were calling in loans taken out by the previous administration that totaled between $2 to $4 million in today's money. The association did not have the money, and they were forced to lay off almost half of the denominational staff at 25 Beacon Street and all of the district staff. Many programs had to be cut or eliminated altogether. Many churches and individuals were withholding their fair share contributions to the UUA because they felt the previous administration had mishandled the finances. And there was a distinct lack of confidence in Boston. There were also reports that the FBI and Army Intelligence were spying on many of our congregations, one of them being the Unitarian Church of Evanston, Illinois, where I will be ordained. The FBI also tried to gain access to the UUA financial records and membership lists. Both Bob West and Joe Fisher were told by their lawyers that they might face criminal charges for the decision by Beacon Press, our denominational publishing house, to publish the Pentagon Papers detailing the horrible handling of the war in Vietnam. Add to this a crisis that nearly split this new, young, merged faith movement. It has since come to be known the Black Empowerment controversy, but a colleague of mine refers to it as the white crisis over Black Empowerment. And it was centered around how the UUA would conduct anti-racism work in the face of the Black Empowerment movement that was sweeping the United States in the late 1960s. The controversy over whether to fund a Black caucus model of anti-racism or a model that sought to integrate both Blacks and whites working together got ugly. There were emergency meetings. There were charges of racism hurled at General Assemblies. And ministers and lay members divided along the lines of Black empowerment or Black and white people working together. At one General Assembly, all the people of color stood up and walked out. And when they sent a white minister back to speak for them, he was booed. And he claims a fellow minister spit in his face on the floor of the General Assembly of our faith. It was an ugly, painful time. And the emotions of those days still exist in our leadership, in our membership, and in our ministry. There were a lot of people who believed that it was the end of Unitarian Universalism. But let's step back for a minute and remember what led up to that controversy. There have been a lot of myths and misunderstandings about the UUA's involvement in the civil rights movement. And with recent political changes here in the United States, the civil rights movement has been on our mind a lot of late. Though many of the Unitarian Universalist churches in the South had been actively involved in supporting civil rights going back to the early 50s and before, the majority of the association only became involved after the murder of the Unitarian minister, the Reverend James Reeb, in Selma, Alabama. Reverend Reeb had gone to Selma to march in the famous Selma to Montgomery marches in 1965. On March 9th, after a day of protesting with two other ministers, they were walking past a bar when a mob came out and began beating them. The other two had only minor injuries, but Reverend Reeb died in a hospital in Birmingham 2 days later. The response from our congregations was loud, and it was one. Suddenly, hundreds of UU ministers, well, Unitarian ministers, and lay members descended upon Birmingham and Selma, including much of the UUA staff and the Board of Trustees. The UU Church in Birmingham put itself to the task of organizing places for these hundreds to stay, serving meals for them in the church, and helping organize buses and other transportation between Birmingham and Selma. One member of that church, Ed Harris, who later became a minister, has written about those long hours, about the trials of finding places for people to stay, and about the fear that the church would be bombed for being so active in supporting all these Yankee liberals. Yet they did it with a dedication and love inspired not only by the death of Reverend Reeb, but also by the faith in an interdependent world and the inherent worth and dignity of all, that this faith would finally be recognized, that this was a moment in time. Ed Harris tells of sweeping the building for bombs, of standing guard at the front entrance, and of keeping watch in the parking lot all night so that the Yankee liberals sleeping in the sanctuary would be safe. Another story about that time was told to me by the Reverend David Bumbaugh. He was serving a congregation in New Jersey, and after the murder of Reverend Reeb, his board of trustees came to him and asked if he was going to go to Selma. Reverend Bumbaugh thought of his young wife and his child, his children, and of the financial strain that his family was feeling at that time, and he told the board members that he didn't think he could afford to go. The board members told him that they would buy his tickets. They would pay for his room and board. Would he go? He knew in that moment that he had to go, or nothing he had ever said to them about social justice would have meant anything. So he went. He was there when Reverend Martin Luther King gave the eulogy at James Reeb's funeral. And he marched in Selma. James Reeb went to support the civil rights of all. David Bumbaugh went because he had to live what he stood up and preached. Ed Harris worked all day and all night to protect those who had come. All of them did what they did because their faith called them to a spiritual practice of leadership. I've been telling you a lot of stories this morning, and I'm going to tell a few more. I think storytelling is one of the best kinds of preaching because it allows us to connect our experiences of our own lives to the experiences that others have had. I hope a few of y'all may come and tell me some stories in coffee hour later today. I am telling you these stories because they show us something that is sometimes hard to express about our faith in words. Why do we serve on a church board? Why do we take on responsibility for a stewardship campaign? Why do we teach religious education? Why do we do any of these things? Why do we take on a leadership role in this church, this faith we call Unitarian Universalism? So much in society tells us not to. We're taught to be consumers, not creators. We're taught to be followers, not leaders. We are taught that religion is not really necessary, that on Sunday morning it's just as good to sleep in as it is to go to church, just as good to watch television. You can even watch church on television. I can give you all the rational arguments. I went to seminary to learn them. But I think they missed the mark. Arguments about the importance of the church, of how important it is to have a liberal voice in the community, and even the need to have a place where we can meet and be in fellowship with friends. They're all true, and they're all important, and they're all valid. But none of them, to me, seems to justify the time, the expense, the frustration, the sweat it takes to keep a church, a fellowship, a UU congregation, a congregation of cats, flowing. Last time I said that, they meowed. So why? Why do we do it? I think back to a night in my own life in this movement of liberal faith. I was the church administrator and student minister for a small, cantankerous, lay-led congregation on Galveston Island in Texas. Our board president called me about 9 o'clock one night and asked me if I could come over to his house to talk. He sounded a little shaken up. When I arrived, we sat on the front porch, and he told me about a phone call that he had just received from an upset member. I don't even remember what the member was upset about. And, you know, in my experience, somebody's going to be upset over something most of the time. As we sat and talked, Tony, the board president, asked himself what in the world he was doing this for. He was head of a research department at the local hospital. He had 2 teenage children. He had enjoyed just being a member of the fellowship for many years. Why in the world had he agreed to be the one person that everybody called in the middle of the night to complain to? Why in the world did he accept the responsibility for making sure that the board ran, that the administrator did his job, and that the committees were functioning? As we talked about it in the warm evening air, a word came to my agnostic humanist friend and board president. When he said it, he sounded almost as if he could not believe it himself. He served as the board president as an act of faith. Now, faith is one of those words that can get ministers and seminarians in trouble in UU congregations, so let me tell you what I mean by it. Faith, for me, is a kind of sacred trust. It is a trust that you commit your deepest self to. It is the kind of trust that when it is broken, it hurts deep inside. Faith is not belief. It's not about belief. You can have faith in your beliefs, but you can also have faith in a person, in a political party. On the south side of Chicago, you can have faith in the White Sox, or even in a newly elected president. If you have a trust in your life where you are risking being deeply hurt in order to hold that trust, that's faith. For my board president, he took those angry phone calls and the late night meetings because in his heart he had found a faith that Unitarian Universalism and our liberal fellowship was making a difference in the world, in our community, and in individual lives. And he saw that difference in his own life. he had found a faith that he was a better person than he would have been without his membership and leadership in our church. The realization that it was faith that kept him committed to the leadership of our small church brought a small smile to his and a look of almost wonder to his eyes, which replaced the tired and angry look that had been there when I first arrived. The next Sunday, I saw him smile for the first time in church in a long while. There were tough days ahead, and I know he was glad for the rest when his term as president ended. But when I was back at the church a little over a year ago, he came over and he gave me a great big hug and a small word of thanks. His faith was still with him, and he was back on the board. The Reverend Michael Dowd, a Disciples of Christ minister, who has become fairly well known in UU circles for his work in spreading a gospel of evolution among Christians and non-Christians alike, brave guy, begins some of his sermons speaking about what lenses we wear in our lives. He asks congregations to imagine that they have three pairs of glasses in their pocket. The first set of glasses is named, "The World is Out to Get Me." When you look at the world through those lenses, you see evidence that the world is out to get you everywhere. The second set of glasses is, "The world does not care about me." When you look at the world through those lenses, you see evidence that the world doesn't care about you everywhere. The third set of glasses that Reverend Dowd talks about, and that I try and keep on as much as I can, is called, "The world is conspiring on my behalf. Yippee." When you look at the world through this lens, the world seems to be conspiring on your behalf. The interdependent web of all existence is not only there, it's working for you. How we perceive the world, how we perceive our lives, depends a lot on the lenses that we choose to wear. Make no mistake, it is a choice. We are responsible for the attitudes and the views that we hold, that we choose to let lens filter how we experience life. As a U.S. Army chaplain and chaplain candidate, I spend a lot of time with people who are politically and religiously much more conservative than I am, as you can imagine. From the lenses and attitudes and beliefs that they choose to look through the world at, their values and principles seem to make sense. And those like me who are much more liberal seem crazy. The attitudes we choose to hold and use change the reality we see around us. Let me give you another example of lenses and attitudes from my own life. I have now completed one or another form of military basic training 5 times. If I ever needed proof that I'm completely insane, that's it. 5 times for 3 different services. I remember one particular day at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, when I was 18 years old and I was going through Army basic training. I was ready to quit. I had had it. The drill sergeants were yelling at me, making fun of me for my last name. Bless you who don't get that. My pack was heavy, and we were marching what seemed like 30 miles. I was hot, and I was sweating, and I really had it. I was running out of water. I made the decision right then and there that when we got back to the barracks, I was going into that drill sergeant's office to tell him what I thought of him and that I wanted to go home. I don't know if my drill sergeant could read minds or if they trained them to look for signs. But at the moment that I was deepest at wallowing in self-pity, he came up behind me, patted me on the shoulder, and said in a soft voice that nobody else could hear, "Buck up, Pyle. It's all downhill from here." At first I thought, no, it's not, you jerk. There's another hill right up there. But then I realized he was not talking about the march. He wasn't even really talking about basic training. In a way, he was talking about my life. I had reached a moment of crisis and of choice. A moment when I was given a choice to wallow in my own self-pity and quit, or to change my perspective, change my lens. I needed to accept a bit of faith in myself and in the institution if I was going to make it. By the time we got back to the barracks, my steps were light. I was humming a tune, and I had a smile on my face. My body still hurt, I was still thirsty, and I'm sure I smelled horrific. But my perspective had completely changed. I had found faith in myself. Robert West and Joe Fisher, the president and moderator of the UUA during the most crisis-filled time in our history, reached just such a moment. When they had to change their perspective, when they had to step away from the pains and the fears and the charges of racism and threats of arrest from the FBI and look at whether it would be better for our liberal faith for them to step aside or to run for office again. When they chose to act on faith and stand for re-election, no one opposed them. Nobody else wanted the job. James Reeb faced just such a moment of choice when he chose to leave the safety of a northern congregation and go to Selma, Alabama in 1965. And though that decision cost him his life, it was still an act of faith, an act of leadership that inspired many. In a way, his death did change the world, just a little bit, because President Lyndon Johnson submitted the Voting Rights Act the Monday morning after he was killed. We could talk about why it took the death of a white minister and not all the black ministers and people to make that happen another time. David Bumbaugh faced just such a moment when the board of trustees of his congregation came to him with a ticket to Selma, and he had to choose between his safety and his commitment to social justice. He too chose to practice leadership as an act of faith. One of my favorite UUs, Clara Barton, faced those choices constantly. And unlike many other people, she never seemed to waver. Her faith was so strong that there was never a question. The choice was made before it came up. Each day, each decision, each board or committee meeting, each social justice event, each Sunday morning worship, each late night phone call from an upset member calls upon us to practice our faith, our leadership in a congregation as a spiritual practice. It calls us to choose a lens for our perspective that says that we are serving a vision, a goal larger than ourselves. Call it what you will. World peace, religious tolerance, beloved community. Some Christians might call it the kingdom of God, and some Buddhists might call it nirvana. I call it salvation. Not the salvation of individual souls for a metaphysical afterlife, but the salvation of this world in this time for us all. Whatever you call it, when you serve in a leadership capacity in our liberal faith movement, you are serving in the service of a larger, greater vision than can be seen by anyone alone. A vision of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all, in which the inherent worth and dignity of every person is respected, as is the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. It really is a grand vision that we serve, one that can and I believe must save the world. The faith in this vision is the call to a spiritual practice of leadership. So may it be. Blessed be. And amen. I invite you to please rise as you are willing and able and join with me in singing hymn number 128, For All That Is Our Life. Number 128.
I love, you call it polylog. I grew up in the UU Fellowship movement. I'm so used to this time. So I invite you to share any stories that might have come up for you. I love stories. I invite short stories, save longer ones for fellowship hour. Or any, you know, usually I understand this is not a time for questions, but if there's something that is good. So this is your time.
I'm Kathy. Sorry, I do have a question. First, I want to thank you for your sermon. I'm on the board, and I'm sure I speak for at least all the board members. Thank you very much for what you said. My question is, could you just elaborate a little bit on something that you mentioned toward the end? You mentioned someone, Clara Barton. Barton. Oh, okay.
Clara Barton's the founder of the American Red Cross. She's a universalist. She touches my heart because her last ever relief effort, when she was, I think, 94 years old, was after the great storm of 1900 on my island of Galveston, Texas. It wouldn't exist today had she not been the one who, when the choice came up, she was there, no question. And at 90-some-odd years old, she led a relief effort for the worst natural disaster in the history of the United States up to this time. So did I answer your... And she was the angel of the battlefield, and during the Civil War, she was the out on the battlefield nursing and taking care of soldiers.
Yeah, thank you. So, I had heard Martin, and I just didn't recognize that name, so I was curious. But thanks,
David. Thank you for me too. I found your words inspiring, and it brought to mind one thing that I would compare it to, and that's voting. Our democratic system depends on everybody to vote, and even though it seems like a small thing and it doesn't count, it really does count. And I think our church, the only way it can survive is if people pitch in and if people take leadership roles and if everybody does what they need to do, it exists and it functions and it thrives. And if people don't do those things, then it will collapse.
Right.
It just has to happen.
My name's Yvonne, and I too would like to thank you from the bottom of my heart. We have an event called Sharing the Ministry, and it'll be up in a couple weeks. And it is a time for people to decide how would they like to give their gifts or stretch themselves or whatever to ways to contribute to running this church. And the famous saying is that, well, I'll be on a committee, but I don't want to chair it. And I hope that, you know, people will kind of think about the service today. And I love the part about the larger vision. It's not just about serving, you know, chairing a committee, but the larger vision of why we're here.
Thank you. And I find that when I moved into that lens of seeing the larger vision, I had so much more energy for the work than I had when it was the stewardship committee of the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Galveston County, Texas.
Thank you, David. There were just two things I wanted to say. One is I love the glasses analogy, and I'm a therapist, and I work with clients a lot that I just will know that I will use that frequently.
Credit Michael Dowd.
So I just really appreciate that. And also for your very thoughtful definition of faith, you know, I'm surrounded in a community that's very Christian, and I frequently struggle with how they, you know, ask me sort of, what are you or what do you do or, you know, and how do you describe what you mean when you say the word faith, and how do you translate it when they talk about their faith? And I found that just beautiful because I do have faith in myself and I have faith in human beings and what our hands and our efforts and our leadership can do in this world. And that's very legitimate. And you were able to put good words in my mouth, so thank you.
Barbara Way.
Hi, I'm Barb. I'm right here. Oh. I've had a real fear of leadership for me personally in my life. I have felt critical about a lot of the leadership I grew up with in the Catholic Church and in our country and in the politics in the world. And
your talk today is a new way for me to look at it. Because I can't just depend on myself. But perhaps with the lens of conspiracy, I can proceed.
On your behalf. Because conspiracy not on your behalf is bad.
On my behalf.
My name is Robin, and I would like to ask you the question, as a working with the military, as a, I presume it's kind of a pacifist relationship that you're trying to live. How do you reconcile these two things if you're if they're going out into a war that you don't believe in, and just how do you do it?
Let's. This comes up every time that I do a congregational response, as you can guess. What I'd like to ask is, we'll save it, and at the very end, I'll answer that question. Is that all right? To make sure we have time for the what's on topic, and then but I promise I will come back to it. Is that all right?
Fine.
Okay. I'll give you the boilerplate speech, and then we can talk afterwards if you like.
Okay. I'm Anita, and I just want to thank you. It's kind of ironic. I never look at what the service is going to be about, and I just kind of come. But recently, I've really been getting into church and coming and stuff. As many of you know, before I left for college, I really did not want to come and stuff like that. And recently, I've been coming across a lot of people my age, a lot of my generation, who thinks the same things, you know, believes the same things, but kind of sneer when I say I go to church. Mm-hmm. And I actually have been really discouraged. The past couple weeks have been really hard. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, well, I guess I'll go to church. Usually I come and, you know, I feel a little bit better about myself. And ironically, the talk was just a little bit about having faith and leadership and stuff like that. And it just really meant a lot. So thank you.
Okay. I'm told of the time. I will be here, so we can ask more questions and have conversation. But I do want to answer the question that was asked. As you can guess, this comes up every time that I in some way. I have to answer a little bit about me first. I was a combat soldier. I served 5 years on active duty and 3 years in the reserves of the United States Army. I was a counter-narcotics agent and analyst in Colombia, in Panama, and in El Salvador, and saw the poverty and the atrocity that was happening in that war and the futility of the war on drugs. And then in 1996, I was one of the peacekeepers deployed to Bosnia-Herzegovina. And I saw what happens to a nation when religion and hatred are mixed together with politics for political gain. And in that time, and seeing that happen in Bosnia, and seeing the aftermath of that war, I saw it reflected in my own country. And I had been I grew up Southern Baptist. I had grown up with a very politically conservative mindset. And when I came back looking for a different vision. What I also have discovered in the Military Chaplain Corps is that this Military Chaplain Corps was once one of the most liberal, one of the most open and affirming and pluralistic ministries in the United States. Remember Father Mulcahy? Father Mulcahy talked to everybody. You know, from MASH, if you're not familiar with the show MASH. You know, he was the minister for everybody. And I found that that wasn't what was happening to the Chaplain Corps. And that one of the reasons I think that the Chaplain Corps has been moving away from that pluralistic, affirming, supportive ministry to a more evangelically conservative ministry has been the lack of liberal voices within the Chaplain Corps. And those combined together, my Unitarian Universalist faith that for me grew out of my experience in Bosnia and my military service, to go back and be one of those voices. Now, I believe, and this is a little controversial for some, but I believe that there are times that military force must be used. What I call is just peacemaking. So that there are times, not just war, because that's silly, that doesn't make any sense, but just peace building. So Bosnia was a prime example of the kind of military force that I personally do believe in, where force is used to stop a war and to provide the space for peace to be built. It's a personal belief. I don't expect everyone else to carry it. But even beyond that, those young men and women in the military are in desperate need of ministry that is open and affirming. And we, as Unitarian Universalists, are, I think, uniquely qualified to provide that. And so I support not only my going back in, but other seminarians to consider it as a process. And as a military chaplain, I don't carry a weapon. I'm precluded by international law from carrying a weapon and by military custom from even touching one. I have a bodyguard who's like a church secretary with a gun. But think about that next time you ask for something. But my job is to be there for service members and to help them find a way to come home, help them cope with the experience, help them grow, help them change, and help them encounter experiences like what I encountered in Bosnia and to make meaning from it. I also believe that there is a desperate need for liberal voices within the military chaplaincy because chaplains are the primary agents of ethics within the military. That chaplain on that battalion staff is the one sitting in that room where the command decision is being made to do things like blow up a bridge or to attack a town. And part of his role is to be that voice that says, "Sir, have we thought about the humanitarian consequences of this? How do we plan for the refugees? Sir, have you thought about whether or not we should be letting the CIA run the interrogations at Abu Ghraib?" I took a whole course, a week-long course, in analyzing Abu Ghraib as an ethical failure of the chaplain corps. So I also believe that we desperately need liberal faith voices and Unitarian Universalists in that battalion staff meeting at that command table. Did I answer your question? Good. Thank you all very much, and we'll move back. We can continue this in the fellowship hall.
I bring up our closing words from the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Would you come to extinguish the challenge flame? And it's in line of the conversation about faith. Faith is taking the first step, even when you don't see the whole staircase. I invite you to go in peace, creating peace. Amen.